If you were thinking that I was slipping out, I'm back. If you want to open your Bible to Mark chapter 9 this evening, we're going to be looking at a section probably pretty familiar to us all, but one that is very important. It deals with what we have called childlikeness. That's what I was going to preach on, but I'm going to be taking the lesson that I was going to preach and kind of adapting it so that we can maybe make comments or ask questions as we go through here as well. I'm going to begin reading verse 30 of Mark chapter 9. From there they went out and began to go through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know about it, for he was teaching his disciples and telling them, "The Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later." But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he began to question them, saying, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which one of them was the greatest. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone wants to be first, he should be last of all and servant of all." Taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me." Okay. Anytime you begin a question with these four words, or similar words, you're going to create difficulty. You're going to stir up controversy. And those words are, who is the greatest? Who is the greatest? You might be talking about a baseball player. You might be talking about a basketball player. Maybe you're talking about, who is the best president we ever had? Maybe even you're talking about who's the greatest preacher you ever heard. Whatever it is, it stirs up controversy, doesn't it? Because it's a matter of opinion to some extent, and people have different opinions about that, and so it stirs up controversy. So why do you suppose the disciples were asking or debating the question of who is the greatest? Go ahead, whoever. Who would take over? Good point. Somebody else? I thought I heard two. Oh. Okay. That's a good point. It seems natural that he's been talking about this, that one of the things that might have happened is there'd be an argument. If you were among the 12 disciples at this time, who do you think had the better argument? What about Peter, James, and John? They just got back from the Mount of Transfiguration, right? Peter's kind of seems to be the most outspoken. Who knows who would be the greatest, but it makes sense that you might think that they would argue about that, right? And this word argue, by the way, is not used here, but in the parallel account in Luke chapter 7, I think it's chapter 7. Maybe it's chapter 17. Well, I'll look at it later. But in Luke's account, there was a statement using the same word that says discussed here is the word argue there. And the word that's used there could be translated either way. You know, discussions can be heated. Therefore, they'd be an argument, right? So they were discussing this, and more than likely there was a little emotion, a little bit of fired upness in their discussion. Yeah, I'm the greatest. I'm going to be taken over. Later, at another occasion, it wasn't long after this actually, that two of the disciples, James and John, came to Jesus, the help of their mother. I have trouble imagining how that happened, but asking for the right hand and the left hand sitting next to Jesus in his coming kingdom. So they're thinking about who's going to be in the best position, right? We might call this status. Human beings want to know where they stand. People want to have status, right? So, what are some of the things in this life that give people status? Money, power, fame, what? Knowledge? Pardon me? Reputation. How much they're honored by man, how popular they are. Yeah. Maybe even physical attributes. I mean, if you can shoot the basketball from three-point range consistently, you're tall and athletic, you have some status, you know. If you can fake people out and act on the stage, that gets you some status. You'd be a Hollywood-type personalities. So we have status for different things that people do and accomplish in this life. In America, the status is something that is more fluid, where a person who has no status at a younger age can work up to the point where they have status. You know, a child growing up in the ghetto, good basketball player, develops a reputation, goes to college, gets paid the money, the big bucks, and so on, develops status, that one area at least, right? So status is kind of a thing that can change in this life. But in other cultures, is the same the case? What if you were in some parts of India? It may not be as bad as it used to be, but you were in a lower caste. Could you become someone of a higher class? Not in the old days. You could not do that. That may have changed somewhat. Even in some of the cultures you think about in the Bible, if you were not royalty, you couldn't develop that status. Now, we mentioned Joseph rising, with God's help, rising to a place of importance. But generally speaking, the average person, if you had no nobility in your background, you were stuck in the lower class, you know. And sometimes, you know, people feel like that's true in their lives. So status is something that people think about. It's kind of a common denominator among human beings. If you think about it in the Bible, let me ask a question. Why did they build the Tower of Babel? Pardon me? That's a good answer. God told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So when they built the Tower of Babel, they were directly disobeying his command. But there's also another factor there. They wanted to make a name for themselves. If they were just one of many people scattering throughout the earth, they'd all be of the same status. But if they had a group of people who built this tower, whatever it looked like, we don't know, but a skyscraper, you know, is going to go up high. And then they would make a name for themselves, and that would keep people from scattering over the earth, because they all could live in the Tower of Babel in the old New York City, whatever it was, a place of tall buildings and so forth. So they would have status. But we kind of have that thing with us, that we want status. Think about the Jewish culture. I think somebody mentioned knowledge. In the Jewish culture, status could be associated with your knowledge, of the law of Moses. In the Jewish culture, they had certain people who developed a status because they might become a scribe, a Pharisee, Sadducee. They had a little higher status than average people, right? Did these people treat the lower class fairly? No, they looked down on the lower class. They wouldn't associate with these people. If they went to the marketplace and they had to go to the marketplace, they'd come back and they'd be unclean. They had to wash themselves a certain way to be able to eat the food they purchased. So they had a low view of the common people, but they themselves enjoyed somewhat of a special status, right? So you think about, I was thinking about this. In the Jewish culture, there was a certain sect known as the Essenes. You ever heard of those people? E-S-S-E-N-E-S, the Essenes. Maybe you heard of Qumran. Maybe not. That's the place where they lived. It was a kind of like an exclusive, monastical kind of sect of the Jews, lived off by themselves, and they left behind some things that the archaeologists dug up. And so, being an arid climate, they could preserve documents and things, and they were able to read about their culture. In this specific culture, they had a class system. Everybody was evaluated as to where they stood. Every year, they would talk about things, and there would be, they would determine in a processional who would go first, who would go second, who would go third, who would go fourth, who would go fifth. They classified everybody according to their status. And the same thing they did for where you would sit at a banquet. The Jews did somewhat like that too. If you remember, Jesus told a parable of the guests in Luke chapter 14. And when you went into a banquet or dining hall, what did Jesus say you should do or not do? He said you got to take the lower seat, right? He says, because what's going to happen if you take the higher seat? If your desire for status says, well, I think I deserve to be up here, I'm going to be number three here, or number four, whatever. And the status was how close you sat to the guest of honor. And we kind of do that in America at weddings, don't we? At wedding rehearsal dinners, you have this kind of thing going on too. But they did it on a regular basis. And he said, you're invited? Okay. Take a lower seat, and then you'll be asked to move up. How much better? Can you imagine how much better that would be than taking a higher seat and have somebody tap on your shoulder and say, hey, we have someone who can sit here. You go sit down there, and you have to take the lowest seat. So there's a dishonor about it. So yeah, status was part of the deal. But this lesson deals somewhat with that. As the background points out, disciples are arguing who's the greatest. I don't know if they figured out who was the greatest or not. It'd be nice to know if they ever took a vote. Nice to know who won that vote. Or was it 12 different first place votes? I don't know. But if they said, okay, you can't vote for yourself, they took a vote, I wonder who won, who got the first place. The Bible doesn't tell us that. But it's interesting to think about that. So let's look at some insights in this particular event and talk about childlikeness. And the first insight, I think, is this, that childlikeness should not be confused with childishness. The two are different. But you might look at these disciples and realize that they were being childish, immature about what they were talking about and discussing. There's a verse in verse 34. I want you to think about this for a moment. It says, Jesus asked them what they were talking about. Did Jesus overhear? Already knew. He had, as several verses in the Bible suggest, a perception that would be miraculous in our viewpoint. He's able to see into human hearts. John 2 points it out, some other places also. He knew what they were reasoning in their heart. He knew what they were talking about. You can't imagine them walking along, and whether Jesus walked way ahead or he was behind, but you know that they wouldn't want this discussion to get into his ears. But anyway, he asked what they were talking about. And here are the three words. They kept silent. Okay. Now, let me ask you this. Why do you think they kept silent? Ashamed? They were ashamed. Another word for that is they were embarrassed. Had Jesus been talking a lot about this subject? I mean, hadn't Jesus been talking about the importance of being a servant, serving other people, and yet they were talking about who's the greatest? One writer said this. I think this is really good. There is an almost comical incongruity in the picture of these grown men acting like guilty schoolboys before the teacher. I like the guilty schoolboys part. I can kind of relate to that from school days, where you get caught. They're caught, and they remained silent. Of course, Jesus still dealt with the issue. Jesus called them around and talked about it, but they were embarrassed to admit what they had done. What was faulty about their view of the kingdom of Christ? Pardon me? They thought the kingdom was earthly, right? And so if the kingdom is earthly, they thought in terms of Jesus reigning on his throne in what city? Jerusalem. And they thought that when he came to reign on his throne in Jerusalem, that they would be his right-hand, left-hand man. They would be in that kingdom and have a place of importance. So they were interested in status. Right now, we don't have much status. We're just a, most of them were just a bunch of fishermen or other professions. They really didn't have much status. Matthew the tax collector, he was way low on the totem pole, collecting taxes for Rome. You have all of these different disciples, and the Jews did actually believe, many of them believed, that rabbis taught them to believe, that after this life was over, in the next life, you could proceed from having, regardless of your nobility or position in this life, you could be elevated in the next life. That the righteous, they believed, would be closer to the throne of God than the angels. Now, of course, you don't really get that from the Bible, per se, but that's what they believed. So many people looked at the next life as an elevation in status. How do we look at that? When we get to heaven, will we have greater status? No? Isn't it true that in heaven we're going to still be serving the God around his throne, praising him? We're all going to be more or less equal, right? We're not going to have one person higher than the other. Oh, I see by your crown that you have 14 stars and I only have 12. Nice to know you. I guess we'll have to maybe get together one of these days. And we can talk about the people that just have one crown and one stone in it, you know. Heaven's not going to be like that. Everyone, you're going to be there. And as some people have expressed it, I just want to be, I wouldn't mind if I had to sweep the floor as long as I get there, you know. The viewpoint is heaven's not going to be a place of status like that. But here are these disciples arguing about it. Who's going to be the greatest? In a way, it's like people arguing about the inheritance before the death of the benefactor. You ever think about that? Jesus, I'm going to die. And they're going to say, oh, he's going to die. Who's going to be next? You know, who's going to be the greatest then? So it's kind of a bad situation for them. Okay. But you're right. We talked about their mistaken view. Mistaken view about the kingdom. Mistaken view about status. Status doesn't matter in the kingdom of Christ. And Jesus points this out when he says in Matthew 18, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So we're talking about the basic subject of pride. What is pride? In our minds, when we think of someone who is proud, how would you describe someone who is proud? Boastful, selfish, good. Both of those good. Pardon? Self-elevating. Condescending. Looking down your nose at other people. That's normally what we think of, right? When we think of pride. And so they're trying to elevate their status. I want to be elevating my status above someone else. Pride will cause us to think of ourselves as better than we are. Paul said, let no man think higher of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment. Realize that there's not a status thing in God's kingdom. I can't emphasize that enough. Why did James tell the brethren, let not many of you become teachers? It's a responsibility that what? It's a responsibility to work there. Stricter judgment. Apparently, at the time, in addition to those two things, there was an element in the church that were of people who wanted to be teachers and sought the position of being a teacher because it also carried with it an elevated status. You had the teacher, the student, the teacher, the student. And so let not many become teachers, because if you're doing it just for that, and you're not teaching the truth, you know, he's not. We need teachers. And also, we ought to be teaching, as Hebrews 5 points out. But he says here, let not many of you be teachers just for the sake of being teachers. Don't make it an elevated position or a status. In fact, Jesus said, call no man father, right? He also talked in another place, call no man teacher. And by that, or by that he means don't make it a position of honor. We are all equal, same status in the church. Preacher, elder, teacher, whoever. If a person seeks the position of being an elder because they want a higher status, they are not qualified. Not qualified. Because one of the attributes of an elder is to have a more humble disposition of understanding that you're there to shepherd and teach and to help people, not to be elevated and admired and put up on a pedestal kind of thing. So, yeah, that's a matter of status. We talked about pride, arrogance, selfishness, self-elevating. I can't remember all the responses now, but sometimes pride takes other forms. It sneaks in other ways. Think about that. So we have to examine our hearts, see where we're at. But the cause of pride often, or the negative attributes of pride, are sometimes the result of having our self-esteem threatened, our sense of worth. You know, I'm going to color my hair this color because I'm worth it. That's an old, was it L'Oreal or something? Yeah, well, I'm worth it. I have this status. And this emphasis on self-esteem that nearly ruined an entire generation of our people, where you overestimate and you say, you are so important, you are more important than anything else, without giving it any kind of foundation. Instead of saying, I noticed you did awfully good work in school, and you've mastered this, and you've done this, and allow people to feel good for what they have accomplished. Instead, it became just a heaping of praise with no background for it. And that hurts people. So the idea that I am better than everybody else can be a real problem. So pride comes back at us in other ways. For example, I'll give you one, then you tell me others. Pride can manifest itself in retaliation. Somebody hurts my pride, I'm going to get even. That is actually a symptom of pride. Can you think of any other sins that would be a symptom of pride? Retaliation. A withdrawal, apathy, don't care. Yeah. Actually, you know, I've said this for a long time. I got it years ago from C.S. Lewis, but pride is the anti-God state of mind, meaning I'm God. How many people in the world today have swallowed the philosophy that the universe is God? We don't want to God higher than we are. We are part of the universe, therefore we are God. It makes no sense at all whatsoever. But the idea is we don't want a God, we want to be our own God. And so that's an element of pride. Sometimes when we're proud, we lash out at other people. We put down other people. We talk badly about other people. Why? Because in some ways we're thinking this makes me better than, have superior status to someone else. Yeah, they did that. I have to admit they did a great job at that, and they got promoted or honored. And then we fill in the blank. But I happen to know that they cheated or they did this or they did that, and so we try to bring them down so we can be of greater status than they. So status is a real problem. I ask you this question. What status did children have in the first century? None. Think about the Romans. Children were unwanted, less than nothing. You could take your child and let's say you wanted to have a boy and you had a girl. I'm using the genders there, because that's the way they thought of it then. And you say, well, I don't want to feed another mouth, so I'm going to take that baby and put it in a basket and set it out in the square somewhere, out away from the house, and literally let that baby starve to death or die of exposure. They call that exposure. What is the equivalent of that today? Abortion. The only difference is when it's done, one before birth, the other after birth. So they had no status, and so they were actually expendable, of not any particular value. I was thinking about the Jewish people. Certainly they would be different, wouldn't they? Jews didn't believe in abortion. They respected human life. But even the Jewish people, when it came to children, they thought of, especially daughters, I hate to say this, but if you didn't want a daughter, you could sell it because these children were your property. You could sell your child. And sometimes people did that because they got into poverty, but sometimes just because they wanted to do it. So children among the Jews had no status either. The rabbis taught that chatting with children was a waste of time. I can't think of a better use of time. I learn a lot from the kids. But That's what they thought. And I remember hearing at our supper table from my dad, you may have heard this too. Tell me if you heard this. Children are to be seen and not heard. My dad would always say that and then chuckle. I don't know if he really believed that, or I kind of think sometimes he did. You had 8 kids around a table. Maybe he wanted to say something, you know, and didn't get a chance. But that's kind of the way they looked at children back then. The rabbis classified children alongside the deaf, the mute, the weak-minded, and the slaves. So children had no status at all. But childlikeness is what Jesus is talking about. One writer said that childlikeness means to permit oneself to be called, led, loved, without pride, without doubt, in simple trust. Childlikeness. Jesus gathered them around and he called a child. And what did the child do? The child came. The child was not saying to his boy, look how great a child I am, boasting and feeling status and pride. No, the child just came. Just humble, trustful, willing to be called, willing to be led, willing to be loved. I think that's a good way of putting it. So let's just talk about this one more point quickly. And that is, childlikeness is the path to greatness. Humility is the pathway to greatness. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. James quotes an Old Testament when he says, God is opposed to the proud, gives grace to the humble. Peter said, humble yourselves, therefore, in the mighty hand of God, that he will exalt you at the proper time. Now, Jesus in Matthew 23, if you remember Matthew 23, that's the stinging rebuke of the hypocrisy of the scribes and the Pharisees. In the midst of all, the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled. Whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. All the way through the Gospels, you find statements that are equivalent to that. So we see something about children in their humility. And we realize that's where we need to be. The teaching of Philippians with Jesus being exalted, having a name that is above every name, at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow, is preceded by a description of his humility. He did not hold on to this equality with God. Didn't think it was a thing to be grasped, but emptying himself, taking the form of a servant, being made in the likeness of man, and became obedient to the point of death. That's what Christ was about, and that's what we need in our lives as well. So let me ask you this question. I'm skipping a lot here, but who is the greatest man? That's easy. Jesus. And it's not a matter of trying to figure out his status. He's the only begotten Son of God. He's the greatest who ever lived. And when he came to this earth, he did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. He showed that the greatness he had was the result of his humility, right? So tonight as we think about these thoughts, maybe there's some encouragement here for us to think about our own life. Are we going to be childlike or childish? And to be childlike, to be willing to be called, to be willing to be led, to be willing to be loved by our Father in heaven. That's what we want. If we can help you and pray with you, pray for you, we invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.